The Rapid LCTR meeting will come to order. And Representative O'Driscoll?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from the much warmer day of March 23rd, 2019 than it is today for our meeting.
May 23rd. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of the Driscoll motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted as printed. Second item on the agenda is a report of the commissioner's new actuary. The appointment process that we went through a week and a half ago. Ms. Lynchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just give a very short overview of what we have been doing with regard to an RFP to appoint a new actuary. We have had an actuary since 2009 in the capacity that is outlined in our statute, which is to retain an actuary to review the actuarial valuations, experience studies, and cost analyses performed by the statewide pension plan. We had Milliman from 2009 until 2014, and then Deloitte was our actuary until July of 2019. On September 26th, we sent out an RFP, a request for proposal, to about 10 actuarial firms that have a reputation for actuarial reviews of public pension plans. We also published the notice in the State Register and posted the RFP on our website. We received questions from firms and answered those questions October 4th and 9th. And on October 25th, which was the due date for the responses, we received proposals from five firms, actuarial firms. On December 5th, volunteers from the commission, they were Representatives Murphy, Nelson, and Vogel, and Senators Pappas and Sendrum, met to interview four of the firms that sent in proposals. After the interviews on the 5th, the legislators met and reached a consensus on a first-place firm and a second-place firm. Jim Van Iwerne Associates is the first-place firm. If approved by the commission, the team that would be working on our actuarial reviews and other work would be Jim Van Iwerne, Mark Schulte, and Emily Knudsen. They were there on the 5th for the interviews. December 6th through the 11th, staff checked in with the references that had been provided by Van Iwerne and followed up on questions from the legislators. All references reported very positive reports and experience with Van Iwerne. Today, the commission is being asked to approve Van Iwerne Associates and authorize staff to finalize an agreement, which would then be executed by the chair. We need to get moving on work for the commission, which would include reviewing the experience studies for the MSR's general plan, parageneral plan, and TRA, and hopefully get that moving before the end of this year. In your packet are confidential materials that include a staff memo that kind of outlines the process I just described, two charts that provide comparisons. One is a fee chart, and the other is a chart of sort of pros and cons, strengths, weaknesses, other attributes. And then the final item, confidential information that's in your material, is a follow-up report, which provides some information from the references that we checked, as well as an issue that has been of a little bit of concern, which relates to possible conflict of interest due to Van Iwerne's work for some of the other public entities in the state. Those are all in your packet. If anybody has any questions on any of that, please ask. Otherwise, I am hoping to turn it back to the chair, who can receive, I hope, comments from some of the legislators who were at the interviews of the actual firms.
Representative Nelson.
Move that we approve the hiring of Van Iwerne Associates.
Would you like to get some background?
Madam Chair, when we interviewed the groups that came forward, they all seemed good. This one here seemed they seemed more personable. They talk more in the language that a layperson could understand more, so that I guess financial gobbledygook would be the best way to say it. But they were more. And one of the things they touted was that that's what they're known for, being able to explain these things so the average person can understand it, so it's not confusing. There's a local firm, and then the question we had about the conflict, they deal mostly with the fire department, and then they deal with some of the fire departments with other employee benefits, being able to health care, retirement health care, and not the actual pension plan, is what they told us and we found out. So, like I said, there were two of them we had, first and second, and I think most of us that were here in the interview thought one or the other, we would have been happy with each. But in the end, it came down, I worked with the one we thought was best, and within the end,
That's your motion to negotiate an agreement with them. Senator St. John, do you want to give a summary of how we went about it?
Well, I will tell you, Madam Chairman, that you were here. I thought there was certainly due diligence. I don't think there's any question about that. I think all of us, obviously, this is our job to take these things seriously. We did. I think we all did our homework pretty well. And we had, I thought, generally, we had good interview questions. And it, I think, boiled down to, as Representative Nelson has said, this more personal firm versus this perhaps less personal firm, larger and more corporate and things like that, and the ability to, I think, work on a more folksy basis with this company that I think is every bit as good. May not have those ultimate resources, but I'm not sure we need them anyway. Very often, if we knew we could hire them, but I just felt very comfortable with this firm. I would certainly prefer his motion proceeding with contract negotiations.
Thank you. Senator Pats.
Madam Chair, I don't think I have much more to add. We did feel like that if there might be an advantage to us being kind of more of a bigger deal to the firm instead of being one of many in a very, very large a national, maybe even international firm, where they might not pay as much attention to us. Whereas if it was, we were more of a central client of them, we thought we would get more attention. And then we were also very sensitive to anything in the proposal that indicated it could be a problem, a red flag for our staff, that negotiating with lawyers or things that weren't real clear or laid out or agreements to work with the staff, that wasn't strong enough as far as we were concerned. So that also led to some of our decision making. I thought the fees were pretty comparable in what people were asking, and the availability of people to be at our meetings, to be here for us when we needed them, I think was also part of our consideration.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of sounding gobbledygooky.
Go ahead.
My first choice was Chiron, and being in the financial industry, it was one of those things where I was looking at, yes, I like the idea, I certainly will not vote against the recommendation, but I like the idea of the larger firm because when you get to the rating agencies and you get to those people that are going to make some decisions on the information they see from us, I think the scope is helpful. To have a national firm is helpful. Obviously, I was impressed because they were really knowledgeable on stress testing, and I do think that we as a commission are going to have to face the reality that 7.5% set in statute is not 7.5% sound judgment when it comes to making decisions, and the help that we can get in that area, I thought was good. So, again, I certainly won't vote against this, but, you know, I do think that we have to look at this as well and say, yes, folksy is nice, but you don't need it until you need it when you get into trouble or events turn against us. And my feeling is that at that point, that the scope of a larger firm, the information that they might be able to provide to some of those rating agencies or whoever's looking at us might be more powerful just because of being there. So, but again, not a dispersion on the choice that's being made.
And I think I commend the participants from the subcommittee that met and spent a good share of the day listening to the presentations and the questions that came about the stress tests. And we asked pretty much the same questions each time, but certainly did give some different answers. And there was no bad choice that we had made. I think we could go with any of the four, but I felt more comfortable with the recommendation of Representative Allison and Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, just a comment. I apologize I came in a little late, and I heard someone say that the firm was folksy. I don't know, is that you, Representative Allison? I don't know if I would agree with that. I thought they were highly professional. Maybe they were a little more personable. Maybe what you're intending seems more approachable. But they still were very highly professional.
And Minnesota.
We like that.
I do. From previous experiences on previous elections that I touted at the beginning and not at the end. But that's several years ago. So, is there any further questions or statements that anyone wants to make? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to present information about the motion? Hearing none, Representative Nelson renews his motion to approve the recommended firm. And direct the staff to finalize the contract for execution by the chair. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. And you may go forth and call Mr. and our board and start negotiating. The third item on the agenda today is actuarial valuation experience studies and messages from MSRS, PERA, and PRA. This is our holiday gift to hear the updates from three major funds. Welcome to the committee. Who's starting? Ms. Leonard.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. We have a joint presentation that we prepared, and so I'll be starting with introduction and giving the MSRS information. And then we just want to touch on overarching some concepts before we get into our individual results. So this is just a graphic showing the statewide pension plans in a graphical form. As of June 30th, total of $8.7 billion in assets. At MSRF, we administer 5 traditional defined benefit pension plans. We also administer 4 defined contribution plans, including the deferred compensation plan and health care savings plan, which are available to all public employees throughout the state. TRA has 1 defined benefit plan. It is the largest in membership. Well, actually, I think TRA is in my mind. And then PERA has 3 defined benefit pension plans, 1 defined benefit lump sum food for the volunteer firefighters, and a defined benefit pension plan. So you are all very familiar with the 2018 legislation and the impact that that had on our pension plans. Again, just as a reminder, that did pass unanimously at every phase of the legislative process. We're still very appreciative and often mention that to our stakeholders how important that legislation was to our plans, and how much we appreciated everybody's broad support from unions, employers, and our retiree organizations. In total, that bill saved $6.1 billion over a 30-year period, and the immediate liability reduction is $2.4 billion just once that bill was signed. And the state contributed $1 for every $3 in contributions. So overall, the impact of that bill is still being felt on our both our funding projections as well as our funded ratios. So it's all been good news since 2018, and that was a key turning point in the future of, I think, Minnesota Public Pension. So we appreciate your support on that. In 2018, our aggregate funding ratio for our three organizations was 81.8% compared to the national average of 73.8%. In 2019, our aggregate funding ratio was 82.2%, so we did see some improvement. We don't have the national average to compare to, so that's why we're still reporting the 2018 information. And then all of the plans that have sustainability measures in the 2018 Omnibus Pension Bill are expected to be fully funded within 30-year end release period or sooner. So most of us are actually getting to that 100% sooner than that 30 years. Just as a reminder, each of us has a board of directors and trustees that has fiduciary responsibility to act in the exclusive interest of the members, beneficiaries, and the taxpayers. Generally, they oversee the administration of our organizations, consider appeals, and set overall policy for our organizations. Some of the things that the legislature has jurisdiction over, specifically our plan provisions. So all of our plan provisions are in statute. Our contribution rates are defined in statute. Our amortization periods and methods. The investment return assumption, which is often discussed, and our investment guidelines are all in statute. So to give you the good news, for our general plan, which is our largest plan at MSRS for state employees, McCounsell, University of Minnesota, and some Minnesota state employees. We are actually celebrating 90 years of service at MSRS this year, so you might see that periodically as we're talking about things. So the original general plan, which is called the State Employees Retirement Plan, was established in 1929, actually signed that April, and first meetings took place early that summer, right before the big market downturn in 1929. So we've been really doing a lot of reflection on 90 years of service and what that means both to the participants in the past and the participants in the plans in the future. So happy to say we're over 90% funded at 90 years. So we're 90.7% funded on a market value as of June 30th. We have a total of $13.8 billion in assets and an unfunded liability of $1.4 billion. These are very similar numbers to what you saw last year because the actual investment return for fiscal year 2019 was 7.3%. So very close to that assumption of 7.5%. So the numbers are almost identical to our reporting of in 2018. We have 120,000 members split between active, retired, and deferred, and our initial benefit for our retirees last year averaged $1,700 a month, $1,773 a month. Our employees are contributing 6% to pay, and the employer contribution is 6.25% to pay. Those have been completely phased in from the 2018 legislation, so we're done phasing in any contribution increases for the general plan. Our total statutory contributions are 12.25, and our required contributions to pay the unfunded as well as ongoing normal costs is 11.6. So we do have a contribution sufficiency in the MSRF, so we have some cushion there if we were to face market downturns or other challenges in the future. The experience study, so the general plan is only one of the MSRS plans that went through the experience study this year, actual experience we've experienced over the last 4 to 5 years versus the assumptions that they had in place in the last experience study or the recommendations that they made in the last experience study. When they look at the experience, they look at 6 specific areas. Rates of withdrawal, which means the amount of people that are active that are leaving prior to retirement, so not taking money out but leaving service. Rates of disability, patterns of pay increases, rates of retirement, rates of mortality, and they also do look at that long-term investment assumption, that investment return. For our small plans, those take place, we have experience studies as well, those take place for 5 or so years, and like for our public safety plans are happening after the first of the year here. The goal of an experience study is to do small incremental changes to our assumptions so that we don't see big swings. And so the actuaries don't just look at the 4 or 5 years prior to the experience study, they actually look at longer term trends from prior periods. Oops. And so for the LSRF's general plan, they had some changes or recommendations regarding our economic assumptions. They are recommending changing the price inflation from 2.5% to 2.25%, reducing the payroll growth from 3.25% to 3%, making some changes regarding merit and seniority rates. So this is when individuals are working, they get step increases or merit increases. And we see more growth on those earlier in people's careers than later, so they just want to make some adjustments there. We're also seeing some demographic changes that they wanted to make. Lower disability rates, which is the first time I recall seeing lower disability rates. People are retiring either at normal retirement age or later, so they are receiving higher normal retirement rates. Fewer people are retiring early. We're seeing lower withdrawal rates in the first few years, so females who are leaving service, we're seeing fewer of those individuals leaving service in those earlier years, and we're seeing higher withdrawal rates in later years. And then just minor changes for males. And then we need to update our mortality table to the latest published and published table as well as the latest improvement schedule. So there's 2 layers to the mortality tables. One is the actual mortality and then there's mortality improvement layered on top of that, and we need to make changes to both. The overall financial impact actually reduces our liabilities by $428 million, increases our actuarial value funded ratio to 91.5, so that's good news, and then it decreases our required contributions by 1% of pay, which is approximately $30 million of savings per year. So all savings resulting from these proposed assumption changes. Our correctional plan, we are 70.75% funded. That is an improvement. We have about 10,000 active members. Our average initial benefit is just over $2,100. Our employee and employer contribution increases they are fully phased in and completed. 9.6% employee contribution, 14.4% for the employer contribution. The supplemental contribution that was included in the 2018 legislation is still in the process of being phased in. Once that is fully phased in, we still have a 2.95% contribution sufficiency in the correctional plan. So still have a cushion for down the line if we need to make adjustments. And then the state patrol plan is 78.5% funded. This is our smaller plan. And in the past, we've talked about how this plan has a higher retiree liability than active retiree liability. So some of the changes that we've seen as far as mortality have really impacted this plan quite a bit. So there's only 2,100 members total. The average initial benefit is higher. It's just over $4,000. But this plan is not coordinated with Social Security, so this is the only retirement plan that these individuals are contributing to as a state trooper, conservation officer, or PCA officer. They are contributing 15.4% of pay. The employer is contributing 23.1%. There was a supplemental contribution that was included in the 2018 legislation, and that's still the process of being phased in. In addition, there's a $1 million annual contribution to this plan that results in that's the equivalent of about 1.2% of pay. So in this plan, we do have a pretty significant sufficiency of 7.3%, but again, because of the high retiree liability and the small nature of the plan, we see bigger swings in this plan. So if we do have a market downturn, or if we see some changes in the assumptions that we need to make, that will affect that contribution sufficiency. So funding projections, these are our projections based on the funded ratios. So as you might see that we are all heading to 100% funded around the 2036-ish time frame, depending on what happens between now and then. So much earlier than the 2048 full actuarial amortization period. So the judge's plan is our other defined benefit plan that is open. This was not included in the 2018 legislation because this plan had some pretty significant changes in 2013 where they added an additional tier of benefits. So there's two different benefit structures for the judges depending on when they were appointed or elected. The funded ratio is only 54.3, which doesn't look very good. However, this plan just started pre-funding in 1992, whereas the other plan started pre-funding their benefits in the late 70s, early 80s. So they've kind of been paying catch-up for a long time. Despite the fact that they are only 54% funded, they're heading upward, heading in the right direction. It's just going to take them longer to get there. There's 718 members total, and you do see that there's a higher retiree liability than active members at this point. They're although very close. And their average initial benefit is $5,680. Judges are contributing either 7 or 9% to pay, depending on when if they're in that later tier of benefits. They're only paying 7%. The employer contribution is much higher. This has historically been much higher because of that late to the game and the pre-funding. And there is an additional state contribution of $6 million that was included in that 2013 legislation. So with all of that, there is a slight deficiency of 0.01%, although that's almost exactly where they need to be to get to full funding. So they're very, very close. The next slide just shows the projections. So before the 2018 legislation, so despite the fact that they weren't included in the legislation from a sustainability perspective, they did still have that assumed rate of return reduction from 8% to 7.5%, as well as a reamortization. So their funding schedule is still to be on 2048, but they won't quite make it till at 2048. And so when we had that big change from the estimated return from 8% to 7.5%, immediately increased the liabilities. So their line is still heading the same direction and the same kind of pace. It just dropped significantly when we made that lower assumption to 7.5%. Just a quick highlight of the other plans that we administer. So the legislators' plan is a total of 419 members. That plan was closed in 1997. Last year we had 430 members in that plan, so it is getting smaller. Our classified employees plan is 3,300 members. That includes current elected officials after 1997 and department heads. Our deferred compensation plan exceeded 91,000 members. Last year we had 88,000, so we've seen some pretty good growth in that program. Last year we were at about $7 billion, now we're over $7 billion, almost $7.5 billion. Our healthcare savings plan is our newest plan. This has 129,000 members and $1.2 billion. That plan was established in 2001, so it's grown fairly rapidly in a short period of time, and we continue to see growth in the participation in that program.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Ms. Leonard? Mr. Anderson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and commission members and also your staff. Thank you for inviting us to come speak, and I'm happy to share very good news. For the third consecutive year, our plans have improved in every metric that we view as important. General plan has improved to 80.2% funded. The assets have reached a record high, and the unfunded liability also for the third year in a row has been reduced. It's all positive, and these go back to changes from COVID 2010 to 2018. The changes remain are definitely in the working at this point. For the membership, there's a lot of members of this plan. It's the largest plan in the state. We get about 6,000 new members a year. Roughly 3,000 members go from active status to retired status. Another 2,000 go from active to terminated, either getting a refund or to get a deferred benefit later on. What really stood out to me this year is that the headcount grew of active members. 1,000 members more than it was the year before, and also total payroll grew by more than what's expected. The assumption that total payroll will grow 3.25%, this planning grew 5%, and that sets a nice baseline for the future, because that's really going to help the contributions coming into the plan, so for our projections. The contribution rates on the top right of the page, employee contribution rates and the employer rates were last changed in 2015 at 6.5% and 7.5%. Pretty important distinction to make on the employer contribution. It's really two pieces, 6.5% plus an additional 1% contribution. That 1% additional contribution is in the statute to be eliminated when the plan reaches full funding. So it's all very clear. That's also the extra component in which was supported to local governments. The local government aid that is set to expire is used to help support this extra 1% contribution. Also noted the contributions being made on behalf of the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund merger. Minneapolis pays $21 million, the state pays $16 million. Those results, those figures have changed over the years, but the total has been constant, $37 million a year. From Paris' perspective, we've always just really been concerned about the total, and that total hasn't changed, and we expect to get that contribution through the year 2031, and then that will go away. So overall, the total contribution set in the statute, 14.55%. The recommended contribution of what's needed to fully fund the plan by 2048, 29-year payment period, 12.89%. The statutory contributions are higher than what's recommended to fully fund the plan. The sufficiency, what that sufficiency is currently doing, it really has this plan on a path to be fully funded in 18 years, on year 2035. So the change to put an emphasis on getting the plan towards fully funding is working. It's made progress over 3 years, and we expect to continue to progress towards that goal.
Madam Chair. Senator Pappas. Madam Chair and Mr. Anderson, I noticed that the average benefit in this plan is really quite low, $1,279. Are these employees also getting Social Security?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, these numbers also get Social Security. It's relatively low. Actually, the median is under $1,000 because this plan consists of a lot of employees that are in the schools who are not teachers. So we have a lot of custodians, cafeteria workers, paraprofessionals. So the average is a great representation of the whole group. It's really split between a lot of full-time people and a lot of part-time. We had an experience study completed for the general plan. It has very, very similar results as what Aaron described for the MSRF general employees. The economic changes were similar. And the demographic changes also were pretty similar. Most noteworthy is just fewer early retirements. And this is even true with the rule of 90 members. They're not retiring early either. So our median retirement age now is 65. As many people retiring over 65 as under 65. All the changes in the demographics really didn't have much of an impact overall on the plan. One thing that did really catch my eye was the comment about the assumed rate of return. So I take a lot of joy in reading actuarial reports and pay fairly close attention to language. And I know I was always trained to say words like not unreasonable or within the range of reasonableness. But our actuary described our investment return assumption as being a reasonable assumption. So I think that was worth noting. With that, with those changes, the impact of the plan was really low. We last had projections done a year ago. So every other year, our actuary does projections. They do them at the assumed rate of return and also at 6% and 9%. When those projections were done, they're based on 2018 results. And we already know some things that will be better with the next set of projections. So these demographic changes will help improve our status. separate from the recommended changes is that annually we do update the results or the projections on future mortality improvements for the Society of Actuaries. So moving from the 2018 table to the 2019 table would be helpful to reduce the liability. We know our growth in total payroll will help. And we also, in this plan, retirees get a cost of living adjustment that's tied to inflation. It's the same, starts as the increase that Social Security provides, then 50% of that amount, not less than 1%, not more than 1.5%. The increase they're going to get January 2020 will be 1%, less than what's assumed in this plan. So we'll get a gain from that as well. So we already know three or four things that are going to help with our projections in the future. And there are two other things that are really beyond our control, the investment returns, which are favorable here today. And then one thing that would be in your control is the legislative change that we're going to propose for this time. That's fairly significant, and I'll talk about that shortly. For our police and fire plan here too, three consecutive years of positive results. The funding ratio has increased to 89.3%. The assets are also at all-time highs in this plan, and the unfunded liability has decreased to three consecutive years. The activity among the members is a little less active than the general plan. The active headcount is pretty steady. The retiree group has grown pretty significantly, though. Grew by about 3% in the last year. So the ratio of retirees to actives is pretty low, which does mean that this plan has a little bit more volatility of results. If there's a change in liability, and that cost gets spread over payroll, it can be a little more volatile. That's why I always say it's really more important that this plan get to achieve and maintain 100% of the employment rate. The contribution requirements do put this plan on a pretty aggressive path to get the full funding, which is good. The contributions that are shown on the right show the full phase-in amounts. So the employee and the employer contributions, these are actually the amounts that will be effective January 1st of 2020, and fully phased in from the 2018 changes. Minneapolis is now contributing a fixed amount through the year 2031. Of the Police Relief Association merger, the Fire Relief Association merger. And then the state is making contributions, they're really in two different pieces. $9 million per year until the later of this plan becoming fully funded, or the Highway Patrol plan becoming fully funded, which appears to be around the year 2031 or the early 2030s. And then another $9 million, that is until the year 2048, or when this plan becomes fully funded. And right now, the contributions have this plan on a path to be fully funded in 12 years. This plan will have an experience study next spring, and I know we'll be paying particularly close attention to disability rates. We are seeing a trend of disability rate increases. We're not overly concerned about the cost impact of the plan, but there are other cost implications that have a lot of stakeholders concerned about the disability plan. Then our correctional plan, also three straight years increased funding ratio, highest level of assets in this plan's history, and the unfunded liability dropped for three straight years. The active headcount hasn't changed very much, but the number of retirees grew by about 10%. They note there's a lot of deferred members. These are members who are neither active or receiving a benefit. This plan has a really high turnover rate, so we see that. We're going to have an experience study on this plan done this spring. It's been about 8 years since the last one was done, so I think that's a good thing to do. The plan's in a pretty good position right now, being nearly 100% funded. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if today it is over 100% funded, as we mentioned earlier. The contributions have been pretty steady. They haven't increased or changed in 20 years. The contributions are very close to what the cost and benefit of those are. We don't need contributions in this plan to help pay off anything. It's fully funded. So if you were to compare this plan to our general employee plan, you'd see a very comparable contribution. But this plan has a higher multiplier, it has an earlier retirement age, and it has a better cost of living adjustment for retirees. 100% of inflation capped at 2.5%. I think this is a good example that shows if you don't have, once you get the full funding, you can provide regional benefits at a very reasonable cost. So I think this is a good example where we want to. So our funding ratios, every 6 years we get a plan to full funding. So 6 years from now, 2025 is when the correctional plan is scheduled to get there. 6 more years, 2031 is when the police and fire is expected to get there. 2037, 6 more years is when the general plan is. And that's based on the 2018 evaluation, if all assumptions are met. As I've indicated, I think we're doing, the plan is doing better than having met assumptions, so I think they're all on a little bit quicker path than what's shown here. Again, as far as we also have additional plans, our staff probably spends about 97-98% of their time on those three previous plans. The other 2% is on the statewide volunteer firefighter plan, and it's a little bit more on the others. The statewide volunteer firefighter plan does have an advisory board. They met, and they have some recommended changes to be considered for the 2025 state session. So to wrap up for us, we do have some items on our legislative agenda. We're talking about the general employee plan before. This is an opportunity to improve funding some more. We've taken a close look at the privatization rules. Privatization rules for CARA are healthcare facilities that privatize. There's been a process in place for many years. There's concern about that process and the result of that process. And we, the board has recommended some changes that would work to make this plan more equitable to all members and also to all employers. And specifically, it would move to reduce the augmentation of benefits for members of entities that have privatized in the past. It would also eliminate the augmentation or any entity that privatizes in the future. And thirdly, for any entity that privatizes, the cost of any benefits that have been accrued by their members, to the extent that they haven't been fully funded, that entity would be responsible for fully funding the cost for their members, not having that cost be transferred to the members, remaining members and employers in the plan. Three separate changes that our board is proposing. The first one would result in an estimated cost savings of $52 million. That's 1% increase in funding ratio if this is enacted. So that's our main item that we're looking at this year and looking for to take a close look at. Our board also has supported a continuation of the 1997 local government aid that goes to the general plan employers. There are 7 different statewide volunteer firefighter changes, mostly administrative in nature. There are some other para-administrative changes, and then there's other administrative changes that apply to all retirement systems. The entire 2020 legislative agenda from CARA was approved at the last board meeting. All of the items were approved. So we have to take a close look at that.
Thank you. Sounds positive. Are there any questions? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair. Sorry. A question on the people not taking as much early retirement would be a positive for cash flow today. But my assumption is that it might be when you get into negative cash flow, hurt us a little more because they're going to retire at a higher benefit
and there'll be more paid out then, and yet the gold line tends to go up as solid trend all the way through 2046. Is there a time someplace out in the future where, because they're taking less today, they'll get a little more later, we go into negative cash flow and therefore it hurts, or is that just a good thing all the way around?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, I know in my experience that when someone retires doesn't affect the liability that much. Because either it'll affect cash flow, and that's true because you're changing the time of the payment, but from the actuarial perspective and overall liability, that either they're accruing more benefit but having to be paid over a shorter period, or less benefit over a longer period, it doesn't have a too great impact.
Representative Vogel. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So basically the mortality kind of catches up with taking the benefit later, and therefore the line tends to go up because you don't pay it as long. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, just a question on the second bullet point on page 21, the continuation of the 1997 local government aid. If memory serves me right, that was something that might have been missed in the budgeting process this last year by the legislature. It was scheduled to expire. Is that the one, or am I confusing this with another line item in the state budget?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll. Yes, this was considered last year. So I personally want to be careful about how it was considered, but yeah, it was considered in the last session.
Time ran out, Representative
Buckley.
You know about that.
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure that I was looking at the same item and that there wasn't a second item. And again, the background on that was in previous adjustments, the state had provided local units of government with money to help offset those local cost increases for supporting public pensions on that. And this would just be a reauthorization or continuation of those funds to be able to keep those local communities whole based on the expiration of that and the ongoing liability that those communities have.
Any the sunset provision has changed. thank you very much. Mr. Stoffel.
Greetings, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jay Stoffel, Executive Director of the Teachers Retirement Association. Thank you. Well, happy holidays, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Slide 22 is the more slightly positive good news. TRA experienced some positive news over the last fiscal year, but just by way of background, TRA is the pension fund for all public and charter school teachers in the state of Minnesota, except for the teachers in St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. St. Paul School District covered by that fund. We also cover some of the members, some of the faculty of the Minnesota state system. At the time faculty are hired, they have a choice, and they have another choice at tenure time to choose either TRA or some other options. So we do have some higher ed folks in our plan. As of June 30, 2019, we, on a market value basis, were 78.2% funded. That's compared to 78.1% a year ago. So slight improvement, but improvement nonetheless. Almost $23 billion in assets and $6.4 billion in unfunded liability. Our member totals count over 200,000 now. That's kind of a new benchmark for us, to be over 200,000 members. And we've had steady growth in active teachers, almost 83,000 active teachers throughout the state, 67,000 benefit recipients, and 51,000 deferred. Average initial benefit of 2191, and all of our members are covered by Social Security as well. Actually, we have one member left who is considered a basic member, not paying Social Security. A teacher in their 70s, actually, very heavily public school teacher, but the last remaining basic member that we have. On the actuarial side, the contribution and funding requirements on the chart on the right side of that same page. And these, by the way, are all blended rates, and they're assuming market value of assets, and also that all of our phased-in contributions from the 2018 pension bill are fully accounted for and recognized in this analysis. We've got contribution rates that are phasing in for the next 4 years, so that's all considered in this analysis. Employee contributions of 7.75%, employer contribution rate 8.94%, additional state funding, there's some state aid that comes from the state general fund to TRA for previous mergers, and some other amortization state aid of 0.66% of payroll. So altogether, total statutory contributions of 17.35% of payroll, and the actuaries are calculating a required contribution rate of 16.72%, and that is in order to be fully funded by the 2048, according to the 2018 pension bill. So that leaves us with a sufficiency, again, assuming all these contribution phase-ins are accounted for, a contribution sufficiency of 0.63%. So don't think of that as the number of our system. It's not existing today, but assuming that full phase-in is accounted for, it is a strong sufficiency. Without that phase-in period, we're still slightly sufficient, but this accounts for all of it together. The next page is a simple graphic of what is covered. Well, it shows a little bit more, I guess, but it's the path on which we are on. Thank you again for the work on the 2018 pension bill, but this is really the graphic to show you what we did. The line was heading southeast before the pension bill, and now it's heading northeast, the direction we want to be moving along. And the good news today is that based on where we are today, we will be fully funded in the year 2042 rather than 2048. But again, just a note of caution, that's assuming that all of our actuarial assumptions are met right on, and that that arrow that you see going northeast is a very smooth glide path. I can pretty much assure you that that's not going to be a very smooth glide path. We'll see ups and downs, but as long as the trend continues to go northeast, that's what we're interested in. Things that really drive that, of course, are actual investment returns, and those will be volatile. So we'll see some jaggedness in that line over the years, but as long as we're heading in the right direction, that's where we want to be. The next page is a report on our experience study. Had a 4-year experience study done along with the other two major pension plans. This is done every 4 years. And really some more good news, really. Nothing major to take into account here. There are some very three very small, insignificant demographic assumption changes that we have already approved at our board level and have reported to the Pension Commission, and we'll be asking for your approval. Active member mortality, so this is death of teachers before they actually retire. We have a very low incidence of that happening, and this is a very small change to that very low occurrence, so it's a very small impact on the total fund. But just a very slightly higher rate of death for males and slightly lower rate for females. Termination of employment before retirement, so this is teachers leaving employment before they actually retire. Not a real significant assumption, but again, both males and females, a slight reduction in the first 5 years. That's a very minor change. And then optional form election means the type of a benefit that teachers are choosing at time of retirement. They can take a normal single life annuity. We have a couple options for people to consider if they want to cover another person for that person's lifetime, or there's a period of time that a person could choose to cover a secondary person. So the optional form election is being tweaked a little bit here to recognize that in our experience, females are selecting the 100% joint survivor annuity a little bit more, we're assuming, and therefore they're selecting the single life annuity option a little bit less. Those basically offset each other. So again, very slight changes just to get all of our set of assumptions on track compared to what we have experienced in the last 4 years. All of this amounts to, on the right side of the page, we're quantifying this for you. The accrued liability decreases by $6 million from $28.643 billion to $28.637 billion. The funded ratio increases by 0.01%. Again, just very, very small changes here. And the required contribution actually increases a little bit, and that really is attributed to the item number two, termination in employment. Normal cost is increasing just a small amount because we're changing something in the early part of a person's career, so that actually works to increase normal cost a little bit, but overall our funded ratio improves, and that can happen. wavering around zero in a lot of these things. So contribution increase, required contribution increase from 17.18 to 17.2. That is $1 million a year in additional cost. And another note on our actuary's comment on the return assumption. I guess I would quote that report. They reported that we recommend the 7.5 investment return assumption be retained. So again, strong words, very direct words of recommendation regarding that assumption. So the last thing I would say, just a comment on legislation for 2020. We really don't have anything of significance for 2020. We didn't have a bill at all in 2019, but we will be coming before you this year with an administrative bill containing 6-8 small administrative corrections, changes, square statutory language, very small. So we'll be talking to you about that.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, our esteemed pension directors, for an excellent summary. I have a question about, since all of the plans are showing some potential sufficiencies, to be cautious, what would it mean if the assumed rate of return was 7%? If you could just give me
an
idea. Simplified idea.
Madam Chair, our board actually looked at if the assumed rate of return was 7.25%, just to kind of get an idea of what that might look like. And for our general plan, we still have a sufficiency of 0.55%. So even if we were, so if we just look at that from kind of a data perspective, just to see if we were lower or if we did see some near-term markets that were under 7.5, we still have some capacity in our sufficiency.
What was that sufficiency number?
0.55%.
Mr. Anderson?
The Chair, Senator Pappas. I don't have specific numbers. I can go just based off a little bit with more of the rule of thumb that is used. So 0.5% assumption change is usually around maybe like 6 or 7% increase in the liability estimate. You drop the funding ratios by 6 or 7%. The other thing that I know I looked at was the projections that our actuary did 2 years ago that showed what happens if the investment return is 6%. And I was just kind of looking, eyeballing the line, so this is not very scientific answer, but I think all our plans still would be on either a flat projection or slightly positive. But it would definitely would flatten out the growth level.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, in our actuarial report, we have a section called risk assessment, and we do a calculation there. It compares the 7.5% return assumption and those results, and then it does a plus 1% and a minus 1%. So I don't have your question exactly. I think we can get close to it, but with a 1% difference at a 6.5% return assumption, it increases our required contribution rate by around 5 or 6%. That's a full percent lower return assumption. So a half percent return assumption lower. It's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5% to 3% required contribution more.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions?
Not sure.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. One question that always comes up, and I have no answer for it. I've seen good answers now that I have you all in front of me. Why is it that some employees can contribute to their pension plan and Social Security, and other employees cannot?
Because. Mr. Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't I don't have a great answer to why that happened. I know decisions were made, I don't know, going back how many decades ago. Either entities could be in Social Security or not, and they chose to do that as an employer. So for whatever reason, it's kind of a final decision that was made at that time. But I know naturally, it's really much more common for public safety employers and plans to not be coordinated Social Security. I think it's pretty rare for employees to not be coordinated. They typically are. I don't think I have a much more
definite
answer.
Mr. Stoffel.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have a great answer either, other than observation that it's different around the country. There are some states, some teacher funds around the country that are completely they're not covered by Social Security. Colorado, California, many states that maybe guessing in the neighborhood of 15, 20 states that may not cover their teachers with Social Security. And I remember my experience at the Teachers Retirement Fund. They became coordinated in 1957, and that didn't happen in St. Paul and Minneapolis until 1987, I think thereabouts. So I think I don't have a great answer. I don't want to appear to be a Social Security expert. If it's jurisdiction by jurisdiction, or if states have something to do with that question, but that's the best I can do.
Yeah, Chair, that would have been my next question. Are there any restrictions to collecting that Social Security deduction on a person's paycheck if they're on an existing pension program? Does the pension program itself restrict as a condition of the pension program in the employees that don't pay them?
No, Madam Chair, Senator. No, all the public school teachers, all the public employees in Minnesota, other than the ones that are not covered because of their public safety, are bound to pay into both the defined benefit plan and Social Security.
Madam Chair, I know I get a lot of questions from state employees that do not pay into Social Security, and they just wonder why. Legislators also ask that question, and I've never had an answer. Yes, I don't have the answer now either. But perhaps tell us what you give us.
Rep. Sam Nelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think one of the big answers to that question is I think the public safety plans were in effect before Social Security. They go back to the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So they were set up without Social Security, and when Social Security came in, they just continued playing into those, and they never coordinated with them. That's why you have some of they talked about some of the plans and some of the the Minneapolis plans that were merged in were predate Social Security, so they didn't contribute to Social Security, and the employers didn't pay into them for them, and that's why they just get that pension, and that's where it comes from. Similar to the railroad workers' plans nationwide, they don't contribute to Social Security either. They're going to get their plans predated Social Security.
Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair, Senator Limerick, the only state employees that don't contribute to Social Security are those that are in the state patrol plan. So, state troopers, DCA officers, conservation officers. And it was a decision made a long time ago, and I think that there's some employers made that decision, either states or whatnot, because of the cost. So you have the contributions plus Social Security contributions. And so I think the decision was made that from a state perspective that they would just pay into pension and not Social Security for both costs. I think some of those decisions were made early on. Beyond that, I think all other state employees contribute to Social Security.
And Senator Loomer, I think the legislative plan, you had the choice when you came in, but for those of us in that area, they had the choice of both or not. And if they didn't have it, they couldn't, or they couldn't switch.
That's what I recall as well. I do know that there's interest. I think there are some employees that would be willing to pay into Social Security in addition to their contribution to their pension program. just depends as an employer on we willing to make that Social Security payment on behalf of an employer in addition to the pension contribution. That would increase quite a bit.
And am I correct that we don't have a legislative plan any longer?
Madam Chair, yes, the legislative plan is closed. It's been closed since 1997. I know that there was one point back when I worked at the House when legislators could, there was a referendum that was submitted to potentially allow them to contribute to the Social Security, and then they would have had to pay back Social Security contributions as well. But that was the last that I recall. That was probably in the early 2000s. So I don't know if that's something we want to explore going forward or not. But certainly do that if you'd like to look into it more.
Ms. Lincheski.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Murphy. Senator Limber, if you'd like, and if Chair Murphy would like to add this to a future agenda, we could do some research. We have lots of files that deal with this issue back in the office, and we could pull those and summarize them and address this at a future meeting.
Madam Chair, I don't know if I want to go that far.
I don't want to go that far. But we might look over the files.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Sinder.
Madam Chair, since we're this far into the well, I'm going to believe there's employees, there's legislators for sure. I know one, and I think I'm looking at another, that are beyond retirement age, but yet they legislate, and they recruit a little bit in some of these plans.
Maybe never to be collected.
Maybe never to be collected, unless we quit. But is there any foundation to the idea that a legislator should have to leave office before they would collect any of it they recruited through the times of service? Or is that just a rule? So if it's a rule, that's fine.
Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair, Senator Sinjum. So the rule, there's a few rules. So the statute says that in order for a legislator to be collecting their benefits, they have to have a separation of service, which means leave office.
Yeah.
There's also some IRS regulations on having a bona fide separation of service with certain criteria in order to collect retirement benefits. So there's a few rules that exist. If a legislator leaves and starts their benefit, and they're in the legislator's plan specifically, so I'm not talking about the unclassified plan, I'm just talking about the legislator's plan, when they return, if they were potentially to return to the legislature, we actually stop their retirement benefit, and then it's recalculated after they leave again. So the statute is pretty clear about that you have to leave office in order to collect that benefit.
And that's statute, right?
It is.
Well, that could be true.
Maybe the fund is counting on those people not ever collecting, some people not ever collecting.
So I would note that the legislator's plan is not pre-funded, so it is pay-as-you-go. So every year we get an appropriation from the general fund to pay those benefits. So it's not like it's being held in the fund. That fund has been no longer exists.
I'm talking about like the other one, not the old, the classified one. Yeah.
Some is just on the songs or off on the track. Anyway, that one person is only 70? Or in their 70s?
In their Madam Chair, yes, in their 70s, mid to late 70s.
And what's the oldest person you have in TRA?
I believe our oldest annuitant is 118 years old. We have over 100 retirees that are over 100 years of age. The person receiving benefits the longest is 53 years that they've been receiving it. Those are what we call our fun facts.
Those are fun facts. Before you leave, will you please tell me, since we started this meeting talking about actuarial firms, who is your actual actuary firm in PRA?
Madam Chair, we use Gabriel Robert Smith.
Ms. Leonard?
Madam Chair, we also use Gabriel Robert Smith.
Mr. Stoffel?
Madam Chair, we use a firm called Kavanaugh McDonald, suburb of Omaha, Nebraska.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Lencheski, update on interim projects.
One of the requirements that, thank you, Madam Chair, one of the requirements in the 2019 pension bill was to have staff work with the City of St. Paul, St. Paul School District, to fix some noncompliance that had been uncovered in the course of some legislation that the commission looked at. The noncompliance has to do with a prohibition in the statute on public funds being contributed to what are called in the statute supplemental plans. These are any plans that are other than the primary plans. Those are the statewide plans, PERA, MSRS, PRA. So supplemental plans are prohibited under the statute unless they are specifically listed as an exception. There are some exceptions for these particular contributions that were being made. They are for certain multi-employer plans. Those are set forth in statutes, and those were, for the most part, being complied with. However, it was discovered that St. Paul School District and City were contributing to additional multi-employer plans for other trades. And so that noncompliance, together with some of the limits being exceeded, was a project that we were required to look at over the summer and into the fall. We met six times with representatives from the city, school district, the building construction trades, the city and county associations, and PERA to understand the problem and try to understand how extensive the issue was, and then to come up with some agreement on what legislation could be proposed next session to fix the noncompliance and allow for this to happen, but taking into account the concerns about public funds being used for these supplemental plans. We are working on a couple of bills right now that are in the final stages, and those will be presented to the commission for consideration during the 2020 session.
Thank you very much. Mr. Birkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 2018 Omnibus Retirement Bill included a provision requiring the LCPR to conduct a study in time for the 2021 legislative session BOLAs. The reason for the study is that the 2018 bill included several changes to the structure of the COLA for the statewide plans. Mr. Anderson just discussed one of them, that's linking their plans to inflation through Social Security. The other plans have a flat COLA. And this kind of creates two different methods of calculating the COLA, determining the COLA for the statewide plans. So the legislation asks us to study the COLA and answer three specific questions. What's the purpose of the COLA? Is our state's current policies consistent with that purpose? And would our approach or another approach better accomplish the purpose of the COLA? So the staff here, and because of the scope of the study, we started working on this, and we're doing that by collaborating with the statewide pension plans, and we felt that was important because we needed the information and the discussions necessary to have a complete study at the end of this with multiple points of view. So I guess where we're at right now is we started working on that, conducting research on what Minnesota plans are doing and what other states are doing. We plan to have a draft report completed by September. We have to circulate that report between September and the end of next year with the commission members and other interested stakeholders. And our intent is then to address in our final report in the comments from those. Included in your memo is a more detailed discussion on the plan. It's a colorful piece of paper here, so feel free to look that over and let us know if you have any questions. And I guess as staff, we really appreciate any input you have. And then we'll continue to keep you updated as you go through the study process over the next year. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Is there any other business to come before us? Thank you very much for your attention and your approval. This meeting is adjourned.